I think that grassroots volunteer efforts, like folks that are taking the initiative to really like push the envelope, is where a lot of that change happens. And it has an enormous ripple effect, I would say. And I think a lot of times folks that either aspire to be change makers or are doing small things in their community, small things even in their own lives, it has an impact and an influence that they sometimes don't see. But I promise you, it really does make a big difference. So all those people, even the ones that came before me that were hydroponicists and urban agriculturalists and working in community gardens and trying to embed food systems in schools and food relief and all that sort of mutual aid work that had come that I stand on the shoulders of, I would say now, is something that really had a major impact, not just the work that we did, but the way that the whole community came together and really made this change.
You're listening to the Communitas of New York podcast, where we invite you, our business-focused listener, to join us in our strategic focus on business development. In our second season, we focus on stories of collaboration generated by Communitas Ventures Accelerator Program alumni, creating positive impact in communities in New York. We explore how social impact entrepreneurship in its most potent form is a kind of collaboration that develops organically with a community of stakeholders, and how synergistic moments resulting from these relationships create lasting impact. Please enjoy these educational, entertaining, and inspiring conversations. This is episode 14 with Samia Lumfadli of Change Food for Good. Sam, welcome to Communitas of New York. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to chat today.
Yes, I'm excited to chat as well. As we discussed before the conversation, I'm really excited about today's topic and all the amazing things you are doing at Change Food for Good. So I would love it if we could start there, if you could tell us a little bit about your venture, Change Food for Good.
Absolutely. So my name is Samia Lumfadli. I'm the CEO and founder of Change Food for Good. We are a nonprofit based in New York City that provides workforce training and educational programming to young adults that want to pursue careers in sustainable agriculture, technology, or construction. And we do this through hands-on interdisciplinary training courses that are free for students that are job seekers earning below $45,000 per year and 24 or younger. And we equip them with the skills needed to design, build, and maintain sustainable smart farms. And in the process, build these transferable skills that we then use to secure employment for them.
So amazing. And I would love to take a step back into your journey. So how did you first become aware of communities affected by food insecurity? And how did you get into this work?
It's been a long journey. So I was born and raised in Brooklyn. I came from a first generation immigrant household. My mom immigrated here from Morocco, and she, as well as our family, basically just went through a lot of different issues with poverty and food insecurity personally. And one of the things that I find within my family, within Moroccan families particularly, but also like I'm finding that it's a little bit prevalent within immigrant communities that are newly coming to the States, they oftentimes feel like stigma and kind of wariness about tapping into public assistance or food resources, food relief, even things like SNAP benefits. So it was very much like that within our family, where there was a lot of stigma and pridefulness around, you know, accepting assistance when we did have really hard times. But that also, on the backside of it, instilled in me and in the people around me a lot of autonomy and principles around self-sufficiency. So I was looking at what are different ways that we can address food insecurity, whether it's an individual level, a family, a community, and really look at what are autonomous, self-sufficient mechanisms for addressing food insecurity. And that essentially led me to hydroponic food systems. When I was a teenager and scrolling on Pinterest and discovering there's this way that you can grow food indoors, grow almost anything and do it scalably, where you could possibly create a business or be able to have food systems in urban areas and places that are not common. So that just was such revelation to me that I believed I was like going to start a nonprofit someday, maybe when I'm like 40 years old and like established and have a good career. But ultimately, I was like looking at this in the far future. And what changed for me was that I went through a workforce boot camp in my early 20s that taught me coding and programming. Prior to that, I was working food service jobs and waitressing and retail and customer service jobs. So I really didn't have any digital literacy at all. I was fully digitally illiterate, I would say. And so coming into that coding and programming program with Perscolas and then General Assembly, It was super intensive, and it just gave me a different perspective on, one, what I could do within my career, but also how technology can be leveraged to advance food systems, to advance community infrastructure, to really bring equity and agency to people that, like myself, that didn't have it. So that became the missing linchpin, I guess, in my ideology when it came to sustainable food systems. Like, can we bring technologies into this? Can we make them accessible and equitable? And what does that look like? And so it started off with skills training and workforce development with the goal of building out food systems, building out technologies, filling in the sort of workforce and infrastructure gaps. And as all this was happening for me, there was sort of rise in hydroponic farm systems that are like VC funded and backed, and we're scaling up throughout the U.S. and throughout other countries. And so it just really seemed like the perfect time, and the ball kept rolling from there.
Mm. Such an amazing story and background. And I feel like the close relation to the problem that you are solving and understanding the needs on a bigger level as well. So can you also talk more about some of those workforce and infrastructure gaps that persist amongst under-resourced communities?
For sure. One of the big things that I found is that most people I've grown up with, including myself, really didn't have access to growing food, food systems, green spaces. I grew up in Brooklyn and Coney Island, right across the street from Gravesend Projects. And the closest thing to like green spaces was greenish areas in the playground. But that was sort of the limit of what I had in terms of experience with food systems and growing food or working with soil, working with anything agriculture related. So there's really like not just physical gap, like we don't have that many food systems around us that we can interact with and get to know and see how food is grown, but then becomes the skills and the educational side. Like it really wasn't a priority to learn about how things grow, what they need, what plants are really requiring if you want to adapt them to, say, what we're seeing with the climate crisis, for example. We would talk about the climate crisis in school at certain stages, and we were aware that this was something that was happening in the background, the backdrop of just living, but there wasn't really much that was taught to us in terms of solutions. There wasn't much taught around what are different mechanisms and levers that you can pull and push within your own community, within your own life, even ways that you can use DIY solutions. Even on a small scale, start to address some of these challenges. So I don't necessarily blame the teachers that we were around. I think that the systems are just not in place to be able to support sustainable food infrastructure, education, skills development, and infrastructure development. So now we're starting to see that shift. Since starting the organization, there's been a lot of like interest around localized food systems. A lot of people are becoming way more conscious about what type of food they're consuming, where they're buying it from, how it's grown, who it supports in terms of farmers and their workers' rights and equity. So a lot of those topics that were either taboo or just were not commonly talked about or of interest publicly have become really central topics in the work that we do, and now resulting in legislation, for example, that has spread hydroponic food systems across New York City schools. And a lot of them have these embedded hydroponic systems now that need support, that need workforce development, that need skills training and distribution and all the different levers that go with food infrastructure. So it's definitely like improved, I would say, but everything from skills and education and jobs and the physical farm systems themselves, the technologies, all of that really was gaps that we're still seeing to a large degree, but it's improving day by day.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Yeah, I definitely can see the difference in like before conversations to now in the school system. So yes. So creating infrastructure and fostering knowledge at the grassroots level in community can directly contribute to solutions to global problems. Also, that legislation part is amazing. Is this recent?
Yeah, it's fairly recent. And I do agree, like, I think that grassroots volunteer efforts, like folks that are taking the initiative to really like push the envelope is where a lot of that change happens. And it has an enormous ripple effect, I would say. And I think a lot of times folks that either aspire to be change makers or are doing small things in their community, small things even in their own lives, it has an impact and an influence that they sometimes don't see, but I promise you it really does make a big difference. So all those people, even the ones that came before me that were hydroponicists and urban agriculturalists and working in community gardens and trying to embed food systems in schools and food relief and all that sort of mutual aid work that had come that I stand on the shoulders of, I would say now, is something that really had a major impact, not just the work that we did, but the way that the whole community came together and really made this change. But I believe it's something like 80 to like 150 schools that it was implemented into in New York City public schools. I believe New York SunWorks was one of the major partners that implemented it and was sort of like the ones that were given the contract to build out these farm systems. Our students are now interning with SunWorks, working at SunWorks, and with obviously other partners as well that exist in this sort of food relief ecosystem and sustainable agriculture ecosystem in New York City. But yeah, it was a major positive that we were hoping would happen. And, you know, I hope we had a hand in, but I think that we'll continue to supply that workforce and educational need to support those farms now that they're there and even expand them out further.
Certainly. And Sam, can you tell us a little bit more about hydroponics in a nutshell?
For sure. So for anyone who's not familiar with hydroponics, it is the practice of growing food or plants with water as opposed to soil. So hydroponic systems typically require no soil. We use a method where we have the roots directly in contact with nutrient-dense reservoirs of water or flowing water, dripping water, in some cases spraying water, like aeroponic systems you might hear about. In other cases where you have fish that are fertilizing the water, those are aquaponic systems, if folks are familiar with them, where the fish grow simultaneously alongside the food. There's so many different ways and methodologies to use hydroponics, but all of it is taking from ancient practices, I would say. A lot of times folks think that hydroponics is a new practice or like a modern practice, and it may have been modernized by a lot of folks and utilizing technologies that are really emerging technologies, I would say. But hydroponics, aquaponics, they are ancient practices that date back to the Aztecs, to ancient China, where we had chinampas, where we had terraformed valleys that koi fish would fertilize rice paddies. And this was a practice that we did for hundreds of years, where we had nature supplying nutrient-rich environments and ecosystems that we could grow our food in. So we've taken from those same practices, we use a core principle called biomimicry, where we look at how nature systems operate, what are some of the methods that nature relies on, which is reutilizing all the resources around it that it takes in, reliance on sunlight as opposed to artificial light, all those different practices that allow us to emulate the lessons from nature. And all of those end up being translated in hydroponic and aquaponic systems. But we also tend to use that as a principle for looking at what are other ways that we can make sustainable infrastructure supported? What are ways that we can utilize technology that stays true to these biomimicry principles as much as possible? So yeah, that's a long-winded way of saying we grow food without soil.
I love it. I just knew I was going to learn a lot. I told you I was going to learn things. So can you explain what closed-loop agriculture is?
Yes. So closed-loop agriculture, in an ideal sense, is being able to have as few inputs and outputs in the way that you grow plants, the way that you grow food. And when we say plants, part of why I say that is that it's not limited just to the foods that we physically consume for nutrient purposes. It can be, you know, medicinal plants. It could be plants for textiles. Like, there's so many different ways that you can grow plants that are useful for our infrastructure, but we focus on food systems primarily. That said, so closed loop agriculture looks at the water inputs, the nutrient inputs, the lighting inputs, the air inputs, like all of the different things that plants need to thrive. And can we reduce the amount of reliance that those systems need from artificial sources like human beings or outside inputs? And when we do that, we ideally work toward having a system that is self-sustaining. So aquaponics is a really good example of closed-loop farms, or closed-loop agriculture, I would say, because you have self-fertilizing systems through these fish tanks that allow for that fish waste to be broken down using biofilters into usable nitrates for our plants. And so that becomes like a self-sustaining sort of source, but we still need to feed those fish. So even though like folks aspire to these closed loop agriculture systems, it's very challenging to have a completely closed system that doesn't require any inputs at all and doesn't produce any waste or outputs that need to be managed. But ultimately that's the goal, and that we see as the most sustaining for the future and a model we want to emulate for sustainable agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now, does this involve methods like rainwater collection and the use of solar power, or are these different methods in a different category?
Definitely, I would say like it plays a role. Rainwater collection and solar panels tend to be more utilized and popular with larger scale infrastructure projects or farm system projects. And one thing that I know is incredibly challenging in New York City is getting the access to land to be able to actually grow food systems that would even require like rain collection and solar panel use. So by and large, the food systems that we build and that we instruct our participants on designing and ideating and building themselves are small scale. They're able to be scaled up for larger scale operations and purposes, but ultimately they are small scale operations. We try to challenge our students to stay within a $500 budget when they're in their classes, in their programs with us, to design a food system that responds to a very specific community need or cultural need or personal need that they see within a food system gap. And so they have that 8 weeks to basically put together a needs assessment, a materials list, pick their location, really create a farm system that is responsive to a very specific issue, and see how that can both be replicable, be affordable, be scalable, and sustainable. And when we say sustainable, we look at three major tenets, which are economic, environmental, and social sustainability. And as much as all of these parameters tend to be a little bit difficult to balance, they end up getting that challenge of like, if I meet this requirement, I can really create a food system that is accessible for people almost anywhere. So some students have gone the route of designing even those small scale farms. For example, we had a student, Taekwon, from cohort 7, who designed a farm system for Pink Houses. And Pink Houses was a project development, I believe, in the Bronx. And they have like a community garden area that uses soil currently. They have an outdoor space that he participates in maintaining and was ideating a farm system for them to do outdoor hydroponics. And one of the things that we challenged him to do because of the limitation with community gardens having electricity was to ensure that there are solar powered pumps and irrigation lines and air pumps. And so he was able to integrate that into his farm design. I'm hoping he still ends up building it. He's in the process. He's working on it. I know that. So yeah, we're just waiting for like the green light to give him some more support. Some students do go the route of integrating solar into that $500 budget and hoping to scale that up, or rainwater collection if they're doing outdoor.
Mm-hmm. That is so awesome. Yeah, I'm hoping he does as well. So.
Me too. Oh my God, I can't wait. I was telling him, like, we'll help you do workshops. We'll fund the project. Please do it. But it takes a lot of collaboration and like buy-in and like vetting and the step between the idea and like the design to the actual building and the maintenance. It's a gulf to traverse. So
I can see that. And you speak about cohorts. So geographically speaking, where are the areas you serve?
So all of New York City are part of our geographic area that we serve, but we do have a special emphasis on the Bronx and on Brooklyn because there are neighborhoods that are in the Bronx and Brooklyn that have both the highest rates of food insecurity, but also the highest rates of youth unemployment in the city. So we look at the South Bronx, Crotona, Morrisania, Hunts Point, East New York, where I lived for a period, Brownsville, Bed-Stuy. Those are areas where we see the sort of like overlap of youth unemployment and food insecurity. Well, I try as much as possible to replicate sort of the trajectory that I had where, you know, I dealt with food insecurity. I dealt with having to have like 3-4 jobs for the majority of my life and career. But ultimately, once I got those technology skills and got that sort of like leg up for my career, I was able to come out of poverty. I was able to not have to deal with food insecurity issues. And so I think that workforce development is a major lever for how we can help uplift people out of food insecurity. So my hope is that it's not just building the food systems that feed their communities, because ultimately you understand how challenging it can be to even produce enough food to feed one person, let alone like everyone around you. Yeah. So that as much as like we take these small steps, I think ultimately getting them jobs with folks that have larger scale infrastructure, folks that have more equity within food systems so that they then become the folks that are change makers in those food systems is the goal. So we focus primarily on Brooklyn and the Bronx for that purpose.
Got it. And Sam, so based on that geographical focus, would it be safe to assume that the lack of farmable soil is a big factor in choosing the hydroponic solution in your work with Change Food for Good?
I wouldn't say it's the fact that there's a limit of farmable soil per se that led us to the areas that we serve. I would say if, for example, we look at the Bronx, they have the highest rates of food insecurity in the country. And so if we can embed food systems locally, ones that are community built, designed and owned, managed, distributed, ones that are technology enabled and set a model for how we can scale them up, ones that can lead to students getting jobs or going into higher education where those skills are transferable to higher education pathways. All of those things can build a lot of agency and autonomy within food systems and create a different model for how we address food insecurity. And if we can do it in the Bronx, we can do it anywhere, is the belief. And so I really hope that as much as possible, not just our team, but our students are codifying their model for how food systems can look in any location, in a school, in a backyard, on a terrace, on a rooftop, anywhere. And so within our programs, part of how we look at that needs assessment portion to your question is, what is the gap that the location that our students is trying to address experiencing? So sometimes it might be a lack of soil. Other times it's a physical constraint, like there's not a lot of physical space in their home. Can they do a shelf hydroponic farm? Can they do a wall-mounted hydroponic farm? If it's a school, is there potentially pest issues that they need to protect from using like a grow tent? If it's a rooftop, are there safety concerns and things that they need to do to tamper down the farm system so that the parts don't go flying on those windy and watery days in New York City? If it's a terrace, like same thing. So there's different ways that they have to look at the geographical area that they're trying to serve, and hopefully they'll design the solutions that meet that requirement. It really does vary. I wouldn't say it's necessarily always just a lack of soil. On a broader national and global scale, that is where we see the biggest opportunity with hydroponics, though, I would say. So to your point, like when we look at areas that have a lack of arable soil throughout the US and through other countries, particularly areas that are experiencing climate-caused drought right now. So even where my family's from in Morocco, they're going through really extreme climate-caused drought that thankfully is being proactively addressed through methods like desalination and hydroponics and different methodologies. That definitely is where I see the largest potential for hydroponics in the future, is in response to what climate change is doing to our food systems at a global scale. But ultimately, if our students can localize that for urban areas, I believe a really enormous opportunity locally.
Yeah, I think so too. And I would love to back up just a bit. So you mentioned your development of your technology skills. So how did you gain the knowledge of forming and building farm infrastructure?
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of trial and error. A lot of trial and error. So in terms of technology skills, I had to like throw myself into a full-time coding program where you're like eat, sleeping, breathing, dreaming code every single day for like basically 6-7 months straight. But coders, by and large, they tend to drink a lot. So you'll be like at a bar with like your friends in your program and like pull out your laptops and start coding at the bar and then go to sleep. And you're like, error on line 57. Like, you know, like in your dreams, like it's the worst. So yeah, it was a lot of that trial and error process. But what it did lead me to understand is that the folks that do go into technology, one, they tend to have like a certain mindset around computational thinking that either comes naturally to them or that they develop through the process of doing coding and programming. And for me, at least, it fundamentally changed my framework in how I address problems and how I look at systems as a whole and strengthen my ability to problem solve because of that. I started to look at even food insecurity or infrastructural gaps or workforce gaps or skills gaps, almost like formulas like JavaScript, where like there's inputs and outputs and variables, and I just need to identify these things and see where the missing pieces are and bring them together and like figure out how they can kind of coalesce, and where they don't coalesce, like where I can sort of bridge a gap, and you know, all those different things. So it really did change my thinking fundamentally, and I started to approach problems in that way. So when I looked at food systems, I took a completely different approach, where instead of a training program, I was like knocking on doors of every community garden. I still do that to this day.
I love it.
Like, do you need some help? We have internships. What can we do? But yeah, knocking on community gardens. And if any time that I saw folks that were doing like green space development or folks that had farms, just really like putting myself out there and volunteering to like plant trees, to do whatever I could to like learn as much as possible. I would say like almost nobody that could show me how to build and manage and maintain hydroponic systems. So that took just a lot of personal research to see like, what does it take to make these systems work? But that trial and error process was very, very like revealing for me, because people would tell you, I have these gaps when it comes to skills. Like folks don't know how to do this, or they don't realize it's intensive, laborious work sometimes that we kind of glamorize, and we have this sort of fantastical idea of what growing your own food would look like and what it would be. And then the reality is ugly, dirty, you know, work that can feel not as rewarding as you might think until you get that like harvest, and then it's like, yay, like, you know, yes. I did it. So all of those things would end up being gaps that these farm systems or community gardens or whoever would have, that some of it could be managed by technology solutions. So the one that I initially focused on really heavily was looking at sensor technologies, as well as drones. Those were like the first two tech systems that I thought were the most exciting, that would inform the growers on how much their plants are consuming when it comes to nutrients, or what their pH levels were, what the temperature fluctuations were. And if they can even implement something like as simple as a greenhouse to expand the growing season and have that alongside these sensor technologies, they could really get a sense of growing year-round, potentially, in New York City, which would double or triple their potential yields. If they were to implement hydroponic systems, they could start to grow vertically, which could, you know, have an enormous impact on how much yield they can increase by. And they would have really, really specific metrics and information and data that would support their food systems' viability and efficiency and efficacy. And so that was the focus area. And then the second was the drones, because one, that was just an exciting tool. It was one of the more exciting tools that we would get students that wouldn't traditionally think that agriculture could be fun start to realize, like, oh, I can survey a plot of land. If I were to figure out using drones that are agriculture focused, that use sensors and spot hotspots and like all the cool stuff on commercial farms, that would be like a cool way to integrate tech. So it was that balance of just figuring out what's the instant gratification we can give to like these young folks that need that. And then what is the more grounded long-term solution that can substantially make a difference for farm systems if they implement it.
Yeah. And I love how you are also making it fun in the process, because it's keeping the students engaged.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. And Sam, you are outlining so many different kinds of skill sets and highlighting getting dirty and into the work, and also coming up with clean and elegant solutions based on new tools. And also zooming out, so speaking of the drones, the work is a testament to a collectivist spirit, creating that positive change in communities. How did you channel this spirit and shift it into a practical execution of business know-how?
Well, so I would say, like, I personally have a very collectivist-minded approach to the work that we do. So as much as possible, I've tried to bring in different partners to make sure that if I'm succeeding in a contract or securing a new opportunity, I'm bringing XYZ partners and friends that I started with along with me as much as I possibly can. That if I have opportunity to hire, that I'm prioritizing our alumni, that if they decide that they want to take this idea that they've ideated during the program or that they've developed over time, that we're supporting them, that we're helping them find funding and grants and connecting them to mentors, connecting them to different opportunities. So really just as much as possible, trying to build what I would consider a more circular economy, even if it's a small, small scale, it makes a huge difference, I would say. Like a lot of the folks that I started with that were in very similar standings, I would say, as me, like they came from similar backgrounds where they didn't have a college degree, they didn't have business experience. I would say not like executive level experience working for other businesses. You know, they might have been like managers or coordinators in different roles or worked for different nonprofits and stuff. But I really didn't have anybody with major pull or connections like that when I started. I just had a lot of really ambitious and driven people that had grit around me that were also entrepreneurs, that were very like socially entrepreneurial minded. Thank God. And like all of them, well, not all of them, a lot of them have been able to succeed off of each other's backs. where instead of it being like a crabs in a barrel kind of mentality, which, you know, it obviously does happen, as you might know, like you can't run from it. But the ones that have really like put their backs up against the walls with me and with our other partners have been able to climb out together, and like we rise as one sort of. So now they're all doing like amazing things these days. Like they're getting nice sort of funding and expanding their teams and going national or international, like just doing amazing work. And so it's a really amazing thing to see. And I would say like that collectivist mindset has been central to that. But that also does look like when we teach our students, making sure that they understand mutual aid networks, making sure that they understand community supported agriculture systems, making sure they understand what collective bargaining or collective businesses can look like. So cooperatives, worker-owned co-ops, connecting them to different worker-owned co-ops in New York City, either for employment or for if they were to pursue employment with them beyond the internships, let's say that we subsidize, then they can become worker owners themselves in these companies. So even if it is like these small scale steps, I believe that, again, like coming back to that ripple effect over time, it grows and grows and grows and compounds and hopefully changes the way that we look at food.
Yeah, it certainly will. And you think about, like you say, like this collective knowledge of business and how you obtain this business knowledge collectively. And I think that's a testament to the support of community, especially when you're running a social impact focused business. So with this season of our podcast being community driven entrepreneurship, can you expound upon the nature of your engagement with the community?
Yeah, so it varies year to year, I would say. Like when we first started, it was going to community gardens, going to CBOs, going to anybody that really would have us, I would say, and saying like, you know, do you need a farm? Can we do your programming and build a farm in the process? And then it sort of started to evolve into what are your technology gaps? Can we build your website? So then small scale food producers, community justice organizations, food justice organizations ended up being our first clients for web development that our students would build out these websites for during their internships. It's probably helpful to mention. So once our students complete their job training, they are then matched to different local employers in New York City and beyond. And those are primarily food producers, food justice organizations, or social justice organizations that need either workforce support for their farms or need technology support on their website, their social media, whatever the case is. So once our students have gained that sort of HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and API development knowledge during the courses, they then can support these other organizations that need to fill these gaps. So then as that evolved, it became going from just building the farms and providing some training to local stakeholders to doing that, as well as employing students where they would build out farms, support farm maintenance, build out websites, recreate websites for organizations for free. And the goal was that these farm systems, these food producers would then hire our alumni to maintain those sites on either a gig basis, a part-time basis, or full-time even. And if that doesn't happen, or if they don't have the capacity to do that, maybe in the future, because they have this reinforced technology infrastructure, they can consider hiring that participant in the future while that student gets experience and testimonials and something to put on their resume and their portfolio that shows they've done client-facing work that had this result for local stakeholders. And those students have then been able to translate that into full-time jobs. On average, those students are getting $26 an hour a year after their internships wrap. So they're really performing well, I would say, by having that interdisciplinary skill set. Now, more recently, we've started to open things up where we've started to do free workshops for everyone that wants to learn how to do a hydroponic system, and giving them like a DIY sort of kit to be able to get started with that ranges from like a mason jar size to a half gallon size to a 5 gallon bucket size. And they can grow anything from like herbs and lettuce to tomatoes and cannabis if they want. So really trying to democratize access to the very basics that you need to start with hydroponics. And then separate from that, I would say like the thing that we saw with the pandemic was we really didn't have any funding, any staff capacity or anything at the time to respond to the food relief needs that were really big at that time. what we could respond to was remote work training, was workforce development at that time. So we stayed heavy on remote work, remote training, remote education, and workforce development. Mm-hmm. And then after things with the pandemic started to ease up, we started to get funding and support around potentially distributing food for free. And so we started to do this food relief program that is evolving now currently. But what that looks like is we have a food relief ordering form from people that are looking for food relief, basically fill it out. They opt in for the items that they want. They share what quantity that they want it in, ideally. And we do our best to fulfill the entire order and either deliver it to them or choose a local pickup location where multiple people can be served at once. So we started that program in late 2022. And to date, we've distributed more than 14,000 pounds of food to more than 1,000 families in New York City. So that was another way that we tried to take this like workforce approach and have it support a direct food relief mechanism. And then now I'm hoping that's going to evolve into a more scalable approach, which we're testing out hopefully in the next few months with a cold storage vending machine that will distribute food for free. The first one is being launched in the Bronx and will be stocked on a monthly or biweekly basis to distribute things like eggs, meat, cheese, and produce, and all the stuff that we do in our food relief program that was the highest demand. And hopefully, again, that will reinforce this sort of community food relief infrastructure that is supported and backed by the workforce pipeline that we're starting to build bit by bit.
That is truly amazing. Truly amazing. And that's so innovative and cool. I love it.
I appreciate that.
You're welcome. And so, Sam, what does a typical cohort in your program look like? Or is there a typical cohort? Because it sounds like there are different threads.
So there's a couple programs that we run, and they either can feed into one another or they can be like taken by participants a la carte, I would say. Yeah. So we have a high school program that's called AgTech 101. AgTech 101 typically focuses on 2D, 3D design of farm systems and gives them the basics of developing a hydroponic farm system in their school. We do this commonly through like SYEP partners over the summer, or we get contracted by folks like HSMC, Longwood Prep Academy, folks that are looking to both build hydroponic farm systems for food relief or for culinary support programs, as well as trying to give their participants education on sustainable agriculture and what technologies support that. So that's our like 6 to 8 week program. It's about 40 to 50 hours of training that those students can get. If they are 16 and up, they do some of them, like I would say like one or two per cohort, become eligible for paid internships that they then can use to help maintain that farm at their school and give that school a bit of a transition period where they can figure out what agency and management of that farm system looks like for themselves, but there's a bit of a transition and support that we give. Then our second, and I would say like our core program, is Intro to Ag Tech. Intro to Ag Tech is our core job training program. It involves sustainable agriculture design, build, and construction, as well as technology skills training. So we focus on not just 2D, 3D design for that one, but also coding and programming, where they learn HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and they use that to build out a case study portfolio site with at least three projects, including one of them being a plant health API tool. That plant health API tool is free to them. It's limited to just about 100 credits, but they build it out from scratch, and they can use that to then identify plants as well as plant health issues in their community or for whoever is interested in ag tech, essentially. And then they're basically like owning that tool and, you know, able to distribute it as needed or update it to increase the amount of credit so that it can go past 100 attempts. And then separately, they also get either hands-on construction skills training or they get their OSHA 10 for free. So once they've gone through that 8 week, 150 hour training program, it used to be 10, but we actually cut it down to 8 recently. But once they finish that programming, they're then eligible for paid internships at $17 an hour, 20 hours a week for 12 weeks. And that is a drop in the bucket, I would say, but it's enough for them to now take whichever path that they decide they want to pursue, whether it's tech, ag, construction, or some interdisciplinary intersecting set of those skills, and use it to build out farms, maintain farms at folks like Brooklyn Grange or Oco Farms or Farm One or Mio Mai or any of the like local food system providers in New York City. Or they can go the other route and build out websites and technology solutions for those same food providers or other organizations in New York City that are doing really great work, we feel. Or they can go the route of construction skills, where they can get their OSHA 30 and their SST and more hands-on training, and go the route of like potentially becoming like a union carpenter, for example. So there's different ways that they can choose to like reinforce that path. But once they go through their internships and they've completed it, we then try to get them placed in full-time jobs if that's what they want, or part-time jobs or gig jobs, or reconnect them to higher education if they haven't finished their degree and now want to get more formal education as a result of the program. So definitely different paths and ways that folks can go about it. Or they can even go the entrepreneurial route, in which case then we try to just support them on business development, connect them to folks like Communitas if we can. Yes. So yeah, as much as possible, try to build up that ecosystem.
Yeah, and it's so great that there are so many options and pathways. So I think that's amazing. And speaking of curriculum, so how is the curriculum developed for cohorts? Do you write it yourself or do you have partners?
So early on, it was a lot of taking the lessons that we learned from knocking on folks' doors and finding out what they need and what they would be looking to hire for. And we codified that into that three sets of skills, which is the ag, the tech, the construction. We start out with broad focus of like, what is sort of the meta kind of attributes that involve creating a sustainable, closed loop, biomimicry based food system and ecosystem, and what principles do we want to abide by? And then we get more and more and more and more specific. So this is what a hydroponic system entails. This is what these different types of hydroponic systems can look like and what parts that they need. And then we get deep, deep, deep into like the practices that are needed for maintaining those farms, for securing jobs, like knowing about GAP protocols. And all of that is informed by and large, I would say, by the employers that we've worked with over the years and understanding what their needs are, but also looking at where are the community infrastructure gaps that we see and what are the different levers that are needed to be able to move the needle to fix that. So as much as possible, we try to go like broad and then focus in, focus in, focus in. And by the end of that course, then they're able to have that 2D, 3D design of their farm systems, a really, really well, thoroughly thought out case study about what is the problem they're trying to solve with this food system, and does it meet the requirements of sustainability on the economic, environmental, and social side? Is it REPL? Is it affordable? Is it sustainable? And then based on that, either they can build it out themselves, or other people can take that same lesson from their case study and replicate it on their own. So a lot of the curriculum is developed off of that field work and research that we've done over so many years. And then more recently, it's been introducing data and research that we're seeing for where the emerging careers are, which I will say is like evolving now pretty rapidly with the introduction and proliferation of AI. So that's something that now we're looking at for curriculum development. Like, do we need to adapt our curriculum for this new AI-driven paradigm shift that we're seeing? I believe the answer is yes. And we need to start to think about, is the biggest value we can give to the students putting them in a classroom for 4 hours a day, 4 days a week, you know, and having them in that setting? Or is there another more, I would say, like optimized way to be able to engage them, to ensure that they're learning at the highest levels and retaining that information and applying it at the highest levels? And if we are thinking about the most efficient way to deliver that information, is there a way we can redistribute the resources we save from optimizing our programming into equipping them with more resources to build out their farms? So those are all things that I'm personally looking at now. I'm starting to have those conversations with my board. What I'm really excited about that is, I would say, like completely not AI driven at all. There are so many gaps in the knowledge base around growing food hydroponically when it comes to different crops that are not as popular and not as economically viable. Mm-hmm. So looking at medicinal plants, looking at different plants that are either going extinct because of the climate crisis, like different things that are challenges that can be responded to by well-constructed studies and science. And can we sort of start to adapt our programs to like build up that knowledge base of research and development and science that can help build hydroponic systems at a larger scale that are not just growing lettuce and herbs? So ideally, can we figure out how to like study growing potatoes and make it a viable thing? And like, can our students do that design and research and development process and then publish that information, even if it doesn't become scientifically recognized publication? That's critical information that other hydroponicists can use. So those are all things that we're thinking about now for the future of our programs and curriculum. I don't want us to rest on our laurels and be like, well, it worked the last 7 years. Let's just stick So things are changing. We got to change with it.
And of course, I think being that you are the expert, you did touch on a little bit like AI. What do you see the effects of AI being on your industry?
It's hard to say at the moment. I think that one of the biggest things that's going to determine how much AI plays a role in workforce is going to be how it's legislated, which at the moment, I'm really not seeing a lot is happening around, like, where are the limits of where we'll let AI go and not go? And like, what does it mean for the future of work? Like, will there be certain jobs that are either protected despite the potential to integrate AI, or will those resources that we're saving on, because ideally the goal of, you know, all this AI and all this technology is to save money and to save infrastructure and make it most efficient, but do all those savings get redistributed at all in a way that is equitable? Like, there's just so many questions that need to be answered around that. I would say I think that one of the areas that I'd like to see AI used is for looking at where are the gaps or the potential risks with the climate crisis, and what are systems and solutions that can be integrated to address those that are data driven. So one of the examples that I've given at other venues, and I'll just share with you really briefly, is looking at the superstorms that hit the South. I believe like South and North Carolina were hit really drastically by this like 1,000-year storm, they called it. And like, we keep having these sort of like unprecedented quote unquote events that are happening that we can't see coming, like for Asheville, North Carolina, for example, that they believed was a climate haven. And now it got hit by this massive major flood that nobody could have seen coming. But then folks took a closer look at that data and they realized it wasn't a 1,000-year storm. This wasn't something that couldn't have been predicted. There were certain floodplains and certain ways that the territory was vulnerable to like a 100-year potential issue. So this was something that could have been predicted with effective climate analysis and predictions and AI that can analyze data sets that we can't as human beings, like we can't take in that much information ourselves. And like, basic coding and programming can help, but AI can really analyze and predict that type of issue a lot more effectively than maybe we can. But we still need to keep gathering and feeding that data to be able to do that. And so that is something that I see as where we can start to assess risk at a better level and respond to that risk more effectively. But that does mean that data needs to be democratized. And there's been like sort of a push to not have as much democratized data with climate change that I hope will turn around. But I think that's one of the best ways that we can utilize AI. The other side of it is the science of it. So there's aspects of plant sciences that if we get to know and if we get to understand, we can really optimize food systems for, and AI can be really great for that. That said, where it most likely will be used is for robots and for hardware tools that are going to likely replace a lot of workers in different levels of our ecosystem and of our workforce. So, and it'll support them as that sort of brain of those robots. So I think it's an inevitability, but it's a matter of what do we do to ensure that we're actually using it for its best effective resource. And my belief is that we can use it to respond to climate change.
Certainly. And like you said, all those savings, will they be redistributed? I think that's a big thing as well.
For sure. So,
and speaking of like moving the needle and all these moving parts of your programs, what are some examples of moments of heightened synergy that you have witnessed in your work? Like a moment when you saw firsthand impacts of uplifting communities out of food insecure states, or where everything comes together elegantly in an outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I would say like the peak of that period was probably the pandemic. and granted, like the pandemic had so many issues and so much like so much division at certain times, but the times that people came together and were really hyper focused on a specific problem and how they can help one another was amazing. Like I saw my neighbors knocking on my door for the first time since I had lived there, like asking if, you know, I needed food or if anybody else needed food. I had friends of mine that never did food relief work before, and they were like moving crates and crates of food with like the military, you know, and like in different areas, and like just absolutely triaging food systems and doing just so much amazing work. And I would say the biggest impact I saw during that time was within our students. There was such an energy and the drive to take these ideas and take all this potential and this moment that was happening where we have the potential to decide what the next few decades of the infrastructure we interact with looks like because of these challenges, because of this major moment in our history where everything is changing and like kind of flipped on its head. So what can we do to direct that energy where we want it? And so the students at that time were like so engaged and so optimistic and hopeful and energized. And I would say like that has changed quite a bit. There was a lot of potential for that energy to be misdirected and to turn into disillusionment if we didn't see the changes we wanted. And to some folks, a lot of that disillusionment has set in. And we warned about it for years to anybody that would listen. Like, this isn't just a matter of like how the climate crisis is going to affect us. It's a matter of if we don't address it in a way that embeds agency and equity right now, we're going to see a lot of people that are seeing these issues on the horizon start to fall to the fringes. And a lot of that is what I think we're seeing right now. But yeah, that particular moment where like we started to come together during the pandemic was, you know, one for the books. So
I agree. I always say that too. I'm like, I saw so much community during COVID. Like, it was crazy that it happened, but I did see a lot of that as well.
Absolutely. For sure.
And what about reality check moments? So struggles or sobering moments?
Oof. There's been quite a few. I think right now is that reality check moment for us. Like that conversation around what is the future of work going to look like now that we have this proliferation of AI. We've been sort of preaching. Listen, one thing we like to do is ring some alarm bells. Without being like too alarmist or like dramatic, although sometimes it like can sound dramatic, which I'm okay with, whatever. But yeah, like we've been ringing the alarm bells on we're seeing in terms of this wave of automation and how it's going to impact the people we serve and the communities we come from and even the ones that we don't come from and that we don't see even abroad and all these things. And we've tried to really like raise the alarm as much as possible and advocate for effective solutions that really do build from the bottom up as opposed to the top down. Right now is that moment where like instead of continuing to raise alarms over and over again that may or may not be heard, we're trying to hyper focus on what are the tools, what are the solutions, what can we do right now, and what does our direction and our position in this paradigm look like where we can be the most effective. Like as much as I would love for us to be like the ones that are like feeding all of New York City as much as you need to, like that is not to me sustainable. Like as someone that came from food insecure households and communities, like it's reliance on nonprofits, government, anybody for providing food relief is not to me a long-term solution. It's like cutting off your arm to feed your neighbor. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't last. Like we need to be able to do for ourselves. We need to be able to have solutions that don't require us to rely on organizations that might not be here tomorrow. Like, I hate to say it, like as much as I love our work, like we might not be here tomorrow to be able to feed the community. So then what happens to those people if that changes? They just go without? Like that's not a solution. So yeah, as much as I would love for us to like keep increasing the number of people, and we will as much as we can and as long as we can, I think like having skills, having tools, having materials, having access to land, to infrastructure, to community, to organizations that want to help, having the ability to get jobs, having the ability to get good wages and what I would call like economic mobility is one of the things that needs to happen. So right now is that sort of sobering moment where we have to like not wait for whatever the shift is going to be to happen before we respond to it. We know it's happening. We're seeing it happen. Mm-hmm. Let's start to decide how we want to address it. And I say this as someone that early in that process of figuring out like what we want to do to respond to it. But right now is that moment, I think, for us to like not keep the same wheel turning. Instead, let's start to figure out how we adapt because things are changing really fast.
Yeah, certainly. And speaking of sustainability, so you mentioned instilling in the ethos of your stakeholders the idea that I have everything I need at my disposal, and what I don't have, I can figure out. How do you keep to this inspired mindset and spirit when conditions do get tough?
It's hard. I'll say that. It's not easy to stay positive sometimes, but I would say like a few things. I've tried to, as much as possible, look at what were the lessons that I learned in my journey and that trial and error and pass that on as much as possible. Some of the practices that I've learned over that period is like emotional regulation is so key. I have such a tendency to get so passionate about things and so deep into that. We need to come together. We need to do this thing and have this urgency. And it can end up being or feeling alarmist and overwhelming, or it has been in the past, for example. So I've started to learn as much as possible to meditate, to find stillness, to use motivation that is coming from a place of I want to build, as opposed to I'm afraid of what will happen if I don't build. And all of those things are practices that I try to embed into our students. We do power poses together. We try to do some breathing practices. We talk about behavioral interviews. We talk about pacing and confidence and eye contact and all those things that are grounding. But it's definitely, definitely challenging. Sometimes things move faster than we want it to. And we have to still take our time to be able to be grounded and make correct decisions. And then the other side of it is just I'm continuing every day to build up as much of the support system and the community that will allow me to stay focused, to stay positive, to stay grounded, no matter how hard it gets. Mm-hmm. And I try to encourage our students to do the same. I will say, I think that our students in particular are very vulnerable to an enormous amount of propaganda that's given to them to disconnect from one another, disconnect from their communities, disconnect from their social safety nets because they're not perfect. Thankfully, there's sort of this counterculture happening at the same time where it's no, community is sometimes inconvenient and that's okay. That's part of the process of showing up for each other, is when it's not fun and when it's not convenient and when there is tension and you have mm-hmm. to put your pride aside and put your needs aside even sometimes and compromise. And it's not at all easy, but we try to as much as possible reinforce that you're not just here to learn from us. You're here to learn from one another. You're here to lean on one another, to build a network that if there's things we can't respond to, that you have the ability within each other to help support one another. And mm-hmm. again, those are all things that made such a big difference in my career journey and my process of coming to this point, that I really do hope that they replicate and emulate or figure out in their own way and iterate it to what fits best for them. But it's a process.
I can imagine. And I like that you also encourage that, like you said, the iteration, what works for you.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
And also, do you have an extensive network of employers with whom you partner?
I wouldn't say extensive. I would say there's a lot of folks that we work with at different levels. Hopefully all of them convert into employers. But yeah, it happens in phases. There are times where small farm systems, community gardens, start out as employer partners in our internships and then become gig employers and part-time employers that allow those students to get enough experience and enough either name recognition or testimonials, referrals, whatever the case is, to mm-hmm. be able to get full-time jobs. And then there's other times where, these are more established organizations, or those small-scale organizations have grown to become capable and have enough capacity to hire full-time. And then that changes. So it really does have ebbs and flows. The way that we try to go about it as much as possible is to always bring something to the table. That could be we'll build this farm system for free as long as it's embedded into our programming for Intro to Ag Tech or Ag Tech 101 or our internships. Anything that's outside of that scope, we do charge for, but we try to keep it minimal to just the material cost and the direct labor cost, as opposed to what we might be able to benefit from it organizationally, which, can be a drawback of the work mm-hmm. that we do, but we got to do it. And so that can be one of the offerings that we give on the front end to sort of bring in new employers that we haven't worked with yet, or try to get those employers to refer other folks to us. Other times, if we're coming and visiting to do a workshop at Brooklyn Grange, for example, can we volunteer for the day? Can we get them hands-on training for that day? And that usually ends up being that conversation starter, that bridge to something like our paid internship program, where mm-hmm. we can subsidize their employment. In some cases, employers match that subsidy and provide an admin fee so that we can help support that intern for more than just the 3-month period, but even for 6 months or beyond. And a lot of times when we've seen employers come on and match that investment, match that interest, they've then hired either full-time or part-time post-internship. So it really does ebb and flow, I would say, but it takes a lot of relationship building that can be challenging sometimes. It takes a year to really embed that trust that the student that does not have a background in ag or tech, the student that does not have a degree in ag or tech, just got this 8-10 weeks of training and now has this 12-week internship, is qualified to perform and outperform somebody that might be coming in with a bachelor's degree, So that really is a challenge. But thankfully, we have a good amount of people that do support our students in that way.
I think it's amazing. And you also mentioned community gardens. Can you describe a bit about your work at El Coqui Community Garden in the Bronx?
Absolutely. El Coqui is awesome. We did cohort 2 and 3 of Intro to Ag Tech at El Coqui Garden. We've also done a few cohorts since then. I think like cohort, I want to say like 5, 6, and 7, I believe, at El Coqui. So basically what we did initially was we were looking for a community garden we can build an outdoor greenhouse farm system for using hydroponics. They had a solar panel. So that's one of the big challenges, I would say, with community gardens is like making sure that they have the physical infrastructure to be able to support having indoor, outdoor hydroponic farm systems. So having electricity, having Wi-Fi, having consistent water access are all major challenges in New York City for the community gardens that if they have that change on the infrastructure side, we can really scale up their potential to feed people locally. But El Coqui was one of the few that we found that was in the Bronx that had a solar panel, and the rest of the sort of missing elements, we were going to be able to figure it out and be able to find a way around it. But because they had that solar panel, we built out this farm system that was 10 feet by 10 feet, beautiful greenhouse system. I ended up designing it myself, which was not the plan, but it was like,
well, yay, you did it.
Yes, exactly. It was so cool. Like I was bugging the hell out of Home Depot and like everybody. Like it was so cool. Anyway, so we built out this farm system with cohort 2 and 3. And then there was some challenges with the solar panel that didn't allow us to continue maintaining that site. So we came back a couple years later. We still kept on doing like workshops and training sessions at El Coqui. We built out benches for them, grow beds. We've done a lot of different development projects with them for the construction skills portion of our training. So yeah, they've been amazing partners. But yeah, we ended up having to deconstruct and move that greenhouse to PS328 in Brooklyn and donated that farm system to PS328. But yeah, we still like, we love working with El Coqui. It was an amazing lesson and crash course in like, what are some of the gaps within these open lots and these community gardens? And like, if we have these resources in place, can we make hydroponic scalable farm systems available and able to deliver on food relief where it's needed most? Absolutely. But without those like electricity, sustained water access, potentially even Wi-Fi, if we don't have those three things, then it's not necessarily the best idea to stick with the community garden model. So we have pivoted a bit, but we still work very closely with community gardens. We try to support them as much as possible wherever we can and try to find partners and resources that we can get those gaps filled.
That is amazing. And I love the relationship side of things. And also, you mentioned earlier your board. Can you explain a little bit about the process of assembling a board and also working together with them?
Yeah, we'll say like the majority of my board has been people that I either worked with within the work that I did within workforce development prior to launching my organization, or people that have seen the participants that I've worked with over the years and like how they've been served by us. So they really have like a deep trust in me and in my ability to like ensure that folks get good jobs, ensure that I'm really tailoring my career approach to their needs, and that they know that they really have a trust in the work that I want to do and that I'm researching every step of the way, that I'm testing things myself, that I'm in the trenches with my students, with my team, as much as possible. Yeah, so vast majority of my board has been folks that are professional supporters of me. That said, we have tried to expand our board a few times and get more folks that are like working in commercial agriculture systems, try to get folks that have expertise in advocacy and things like that. So it's been challenging though to find new board members, I will say. Like we're still recruiting. If anybody is interested and is listening, please hit me up. Right. I have like a dream board in my mind that I want to get to when we're scaling up someday. And that's folks that are really grounded in science, really grounded in construction and infrastructure and the stuff that I don't know. People that are experts in HVAC systems. Like I need to understand the stuff that I just don't physically have the time to learn. Like I can't learn HVAC right now. You know, so like it'd be great if I had board members that could fill those gaps. I'd love to build a board that has like fundraising expertise or like connections to funding that just, you know, straight up, like I just don't have those resources. Like I don't know people that have money like that. So like, that's like one of the challenges of nonprofits. You just gotta like know people with money that like can source donors, can source philanthropists and stuff like that. And I just don't, you know, so it's a constant like outreach process and like putting myself out there and like spreading the word of our organization and being transparent about what the challenges are so that hopefully good people come to the table that are like, hey, this is what you need to do. I'm here to help you. What can I do?
And speaking of, you are doing amazing things, not just here locally, but also like globally. So I would love to talk about your work in Kenya and what you learn in your work there about climate cause drought hindering production on farmlands.
So long story short, I got into this program that allowed me to go out to Kenya for like a few weeks that basically was putting you through this intensive training. You get up every day and you run 2 miles, almost like military style training. It was so cool though. We were like camping in the Maasai Plains and like, you know, planting trees for schools. Just really, really cool stuff. But yeah, it was super duper intensive. And the goal is by the end of that training to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, which was insane. I didn't make it to the top. Nobody summited that year, unfortunately. There was a lot of crazy weather going on right at the end of the climbing season. So it was very intense. So yeah, unfortunately, nobody got to summit, including me. But that journey was so life-changing. And when we came back, we were in Tanzania and I was starting to understand from the people that were in that program with me who are local Kenyans and Tanzanians that they have one major solar grid infrastructure. Like I don't find that in New York City or like where I'm from, you know? So like they have this like major potential and investment that's being done in solar electricity. They also have a really, really major problem when it came at that time, when it came to climate caused drought. It was like the epicenter of climate caused drought at the time. And they were in a state of emergency having been declared by their government to address the issues when it came to climate caused drought. And then furthermore, when I was learning and working with the schools and planting trees and understanding like what their food program looks like, they had newly implemented a lunch program, which in New York City or in America, it's like commonplace to have lunch in schools. In other countries, that's not as common and is not as available as it is in the US. So in Kenya, they had just implemented this food program for lunches where they would be served maize and beans. And then one day a week, they would serve rice and beans for the lunch for the students. And I learned from the participants in that program and from eating lunch and dinner in the Maasai Plains with these folks like that, they were surviving on that one meal a day and maybe even having like something called ugali, which is sort of like grits, but if grits were like a brick. So, and it tastes, I love it. Like, I'm like a big fan of like certain foods that you could put just a bunch of sauce and stew and like some veggies on and make it taste. Ugali is perfect for that. But yeah, I was finding out that they would basically have like a bit of ugali in the morning and then that lunch for their children and then pretty much nothing after that. And so even something as simple as if we were to supplement diets with kale and something called skumawiki, which is like a kale collard dish that's very common in Kenya that I absolutely fell in love with. If we were able to do that on one of the school sites that, for example, we planted trees on, you know, we could fundamentally change the way that their diets and their nutrition is being addressed. But furthermore, we can give them a model for growing food that responds to the climate caused drought that they were being impacted by, that allows them to have an economic development resource that they might not have access to currently, that is utilizing sustainable infrastructure that they either already have or can easily implement, like you said, for example, solar and rainwater collection. And then they can provide education to the students that are there, as well as that supplemental nutrition for their food program. So that was sort of the North Star for me when I first started. When we did our first fundraiser, like that was what I was telling folks. I was like, we're gonna go back to Kenya. We're gonna build this farm system. This is what it's gonna cost. Help me out. Like, long story short, it took about 5 years to make it happen because, oh Lordy Jesus, everything that could possibly get in the way literally got in the way. But it's okay. We had so many supporters, so many people that wanted to make it happen that, you know, allowed me to keep that vision up for 5 years, including the people that I met from that program who ended up being folks that helped us build the farm system at a primary school in Nairobi. And so that farm system, it was growing 13,000 plants per year, really gorgeous, like hydroponic system. We partnered with Vertical Gardens LTD in Kenya to be able to design it and build it, to embed a water catchment system using rainwater collection. We made sure that we did a rainwater collection reservoir that was way bigger than we needed so that if folks needed supplemental water nearby, which oftentimes was a challenge for the school, teachers and students, that they would have access to water. We included solar panel systems that, again, had excess electricity being generated from it so that if they needed to tap into it at the school, they could. So yeah, we ended up building that farm system, I believe, end of 2023. Yes, end of 2023, like September 2023, we launched that farm system officially. It was absolutely amazing to see it come to life. The goal initially was to bring out students, our alumni from Intro to Ag Tech, to be able to build out that farm system physically in Kenya. But, you know, when the pandemic hit and all these challenges were happening, we had to sit our students down who applied for that program and say, like, listen, I'm going to be straight up with you. Can we go out to Kenya and make this happen? Yes. Will it take an enormous amount of time, energy, money, and take out money from the people that are there who we can potentially support with the funds that we're using to bring you out here? Yes. If you want to do that, I will back you up. It will take an enormous amount of time and we will make it happen. But if you all vote and say that you want to back out of the physical trip to Kenya and instead we hire a local firm, a local organization in Nairobi to build out this farm system and we directly employ the people that we've met through this program to be able to maintain it, then that's what we'll do. So we put it to a vote and they all voted yes, thank God. But yeah, it was an amazing project. And then earlier this year, we finished out that year's worth of funding that we had for it. We tried to apply for like different funding sources like UNCF, UNFCU, and like DRK Foundation, like a few folks. We don't really have like an international funding resource really. So we had to rely on donations. And so once that ran out, unfortunately, we didn't get any further funding and we transitioned over to the farm system being owned, managed, and maintained by the school and by the folks that we worked with. So they now own it, operate it, do what they please with it. Hopefully they turn it into like a business that generates its own income and can sustain the employment of the people there and can still supplement the nutrition of the students. But yeah, again, all of those things were based on the same principles that we teach our students. And even some of our students have gone on to like build out farm systems internationally. Even one of our students did one in Mexico. A student designed a farm system for Antigua, and I'm hoping that she does it someday. Yeah. So like the buck doesn't stop with us, you know, ultimately we're just an example of what can be done and what can go wrong, I would say. That hopefully our students learn from, they run with it and, you know, do even better than us someday.
And so you were still able to have an impact in Nairobi. And it also seems like you were able to apply these lessons based on your time in Kenya back to your work here in New York, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so speaking of funding, may I ask, what are some of your other funding sources and how do you deal with funding?
So primarily for the first few years, our funding was, say, about like 65 to 70% was philanthropic support, like foundations and organizations like those. And then about like 25% was from government stipends, like the ones that fund our internship program, for example. At the time, we didn't really get much government funding. We still don't to this day, which is fine. It can have its own challenges as well. And then the rest is from like contracts that we get either with schools or with CBOs or like a small amount of individual donations that we get here and there or board member contributions. But by and large, our biggest supporters are for sure philanthropic organizations.
That's awesome. Now, we are on the Communitas of New York podcast, and you are a member of Cohort 2 of the Communitas Ventures Accelerator Program. Can you say a little bit about your experience with Communitas America?
Absolutely. It was like the best pitch accelerator I've ever gone through. Like, yay. Basically, yeah, it was really cool. Like when we were in Cohort 2, I don't know if things have changed now. So if I'm like not representing like what it currently is, my apologies. But when I was in the program, we were using business model canvases. They weren't super common at that time, at least with the people that I knew. It felt like we were like getting the keys to like business development overnight. Instead of having to write a 70-page business plan, we had this one-page document that would like break down how we build our business together. And so we would break that down into like week by week, developing out our key resources, our revenue streams, our key channels, our key customer supports, and like how we build those relationships. And every single week we were building out that pitch deck to reinforce and like strengthen those specific segments. And then every week we were pitching. Once or twice per session, we were pitching either in a practice and then in a live practice or a live pitch. Yeah. And like that was my hardest pitch practice I think I'd ever had because I had a hard time keeping things under the 3-minute mark. So like it was such a struggle, but and then not talking too fast too. Those were always my two biggest struggles with pitching. But by the end of, I don't remember if it was 10 weeks. I think it was 10 weeks, right? It was an intensive course though. Then by the end of that, pitch to a live audience and to folks that have experience in like venture capitalism or like community social enterprise development and compete for, I think it was like a 10K grant or something like that. I believe we came in like second or third place. The guys that won, if I remember correctly, were like these awesome education resource consultants. So I was very excited that they won. But yeah, it was a really great practice. It made me, like, I would say, really, really effective at pitching. Taught me so much about business model canvases and business development. So that was a really great experience.
I love that. And I agree. It was a great experience as well. And have you had the opportunity to collaborate with other Communitas Ventures alumni or had any mentorship experience amongst the community?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I would take on the role of mentor just yet. I feel like informally I've mentored some people, but not like Communitas alumni. But mostly I would say, if you recall, like that network of entrepreneurs that I mentioned, that either like we kind of put our backs together and climbed up out the well together type of thing. A few of those were folks that either were in cohort one of Communitas or in future cohorts or in my cohort, and were folks that like either would give me like words of inspiration, would help me with like a logo, or help me with like, I wanted to do some project management and get like a freelance gig, and like one of them hired me and like hired my students, just things like that, that like it just became like this circular community ecosystem. So yeah, they've been incredibly supportive. I would say like, especially early on, they were like closest entrepreneurs network was formed through like Communitas as well as from the Knowledge House and Perscolis. And yeah, they were really great for sure.
Awesome. And have you used the Hagrun Harlem space for your venture, or have you attended any events there?
Hagrun is Communitas America's incubation space in Harlem.
I have not used the Hagrun Harlem space yet, but we talked about it with Edward.
Edward Greenwood is the head of venture resources for Communitas America.
Okay, so one thing with like hydroponics that's challenging in New York City is that you do need to be able to have land access to grow food. But the place that you grow your food for consumption and for food distribution ideally shouldn't be the same place that you bring students, workshop participants, wow, like random people to. So you want to have like a demo site if you can, which we don't have, other than like our school sites. And they're not available year round, close at certain times of day, and they have after school programs that you have to like navigate. So we did talk with Edward about renting out space at Hagrun Harlem to like put a hydroponic system to demo.
Use some resources.
Right. Like, but yeah, I don't know that that specific idea was a great idea, just because we still need water access. And that was one of the challenges. But they did refer us to like co-warehousing spaces in Manhattan that we might be able to tap into. We're still like vetting locations currently. But no, we haven't used it yet. Maybe soon.
Maybe soon.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about the future and impact. So I read in an article from 2023 that you were aiming to build out 100 forum systems by 2025, and that at that point you were around 80% of the way there. Where are you in terms of this goal, and what challenges you have faced in terms of reaching it?
Yeah, I'm 99% sure we far exceeded that goal. Yes, ma'am. But I do want to correct something, just that can be a bit of misconception when we talk about those farm systems. Mm-hmm. The range in terms of scale and size is just not captured by that term green spaces farm. So it can feel like, are all of the farms as big as the one in Kenya that grows like 13,000 plants per year? No. They range from like small scale windowsill DIY hydroponic systems to 26-foot greenhouse that we built with a partner in Brooklyn. So it just like can range in size so much that for me personally, what I looked at it as for the goal by 2025 was, if we establish that we can train 1,500 participants, place 250 jobs of our alumni, that we can build out or distribute 100 farm systems and embed them locally or for communities that need it. Mm-hmm. What I believe is that this will inform and establish a model that, one, is either scalable and or can be codified and replicated elsewhere, or at the very least is going to give us lessons that allow us to better understand what it takes to change our food system. And at this stage, now that we're coming to the close of 2025, we've exceeded that goal of that 100 farms by distributing out free hydroponic farm kits, by making sure that we've built them in community gardens, in people's homes, in schools, just basically trying to build out hydroponic systems wherever we physically can. Now that we've understood what it takes and where the challenges are, what we're looking at for our like 2030 goals is, instead of the number of farms, looking at the square and cubic footage of space that we catalyze farm system development in. And that can also look like supporting existing farm systems, ensuring that square footage and cubic footage is supported by our workforce pipeline. And the big reason why I say that is because when we think about food systems, to your point earlier of like, is the challenge having arable soil? Like, yes, that is a major challenge, but the benefit of these hydroponic farm systems is that indoor access can be unlocked. Vertical growing can be unlocked. We're really not limited to this this length and width plane that we're operating on. We now have height that we can work with. And so when we take it into consideration in that way, there's an enormous amount of farm system development that's happening that really doesn't get captured and illustrated by just the number of farms that we build or support. So that is where we've started to like gather that data of how much square footage and cubic footage have we physically built out so far. Mm-hmm. And based on that, how can we then set targets and goals for what we want to do by 2030? And what does that look like? Does it look like small scale DIY kits still? Or does that look like more embedded rooftop infrastructure or whatever the case is? So now is that time that we've used this like 2025 goal period to inform what does our ecosystem look like? What are the challenges that it's facing? What is it evolving into over the next few years? Where are the successes and where are the failures? And if we've now codified that methodology, can we now use more illustrative metrics that fundamentally shift the amount of feet that are accessible for food system relief? So that's where we're going for 2030. But yeah, it's a process, baby steps. Yeah. But yes, we have exceeded that metric, I would say.
Yes. Goal set and goal met. I love
Thank
it.
You.
Yeah. And speaking of the future, so what are the future goals of Change Food for Good? And you mentioned the cold storage solution, for example.
Yeah. So what my hope is that online learning and gamified learning becomes a really central element of our work and our model. Mm-hmm. My belief is that if we can utilize those resources and those tools, if we can build them ourselves and take our existing training and really unlock it by having that online and gamified learning model, we can reach an enormous amount more people than we currently do. So hopefully I've set some like tentative goals. I'm scared mm-hmm. to share it, but I'll just be transparent. And then if we have to shift it, I'll tell you guys, I'll let you guys know. I'm sorry.
That is real.
Right. But hopefully by 2030, if we can establish online and gamified learning models, I believe mm-hmm. that we can reach 5,000 participants trained over the life of the organization. So that would take us from, you know, 5, 6, 7 years to train 1,500 participants to 5 years to train 3,500 more participants. If we unlock those other scalable resources, we can do. And so we started to test that out through like uses of AR, VR tools that we're building out, like pilot systems and small scale Quizlets and gamified learning modules. And I'm really hoping that that becomes how we change the model, as well as self-paced learning and online learning resources. That I think is going to be a way that we can expand beyond the limitation of like, how much staff capacity do we have? How many alumni actually want to teach, you know, because that's always for sure a challenge. And if we can overcome that challenge by making the learning more accessible, we can redistribute those resources into all those new students that are getting that training. How many of them want to build farms? Great. We can mm-hmm. start to fund that infrastructure, connect them to access to spaces where they can grow that food, where they can then become, I believe, like research and development hubs that publish information on this is how you grow saffron in these conditions, and this is what I did. This is how you optimize the light cycles for potatoes so that you can get past those initial tubers and get full-scale potato grown in a hydroponic system. And these are the challenges that you can fight off this type of plant disease by doing these steps. And I've tested it, created a scientific study around it. I'm publishing it. It might not be like in a scientific peer-reviewed journal, but I'm still going to increase that knowledge base. And I think that's the big direction I'd like to go into. And then aside from that, that sort of parallel food relief model that sort of intersects with this workforce model, I think can be scaled through the use of those cold storage vending machine systems. I have still to be able to figure out like how many pounds of food can we realistically distribute and how frequently, and you know, what are the challenges that come with those machines. Once we get that pilot project launched in the Bronx and really study and see data that we're getting behind that, what are the requested items that folks are submitting? through the QR code that we'll have available. What are the funding limitations even that we have to be able to get this going? All of those things will help us determine how many pounds of food do we think we realistically can distribute and what percentage of that food will be directly generated by the farm systems we build and that our students build. So there's still a lot more information and data that is going to drive 2030 goals, but hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have a better sense of how this is going to evolve for the next 5 years. Our ideas are cooking. Don't worry. I got you.
I mean, I can see it because like you said, you already surpassed that goal from 2023 that mentioned. So I could see it for sure. You also are talking about the different quantitative and qualitative ways you have goals for impact and you observe your impact. On a person-to-person basis, have you encountered community members later down the line, for instance, a year or two later, who have shared their positive outcomes with you?
Yeah, for sure. It definitely ranges. Some students, they'll like keep hitting me up like, you know, I got promoted. I moved from New York to Florida. Mm-hmm. I just got full time at like this tech firm interviewing at Google. Can you help me out? Can you give a recommendation letter, you know, from when I taught for you? A lot of them end up coming back, even if they get full time or part time work, wanting to still support in some way or like getting our students a foot in the door at the companies that they're in, which is perfect. That's like the lift as you rise kind of model that we keep trying to reinforce. So yeah, it definitely ranges for sure. I would say like some students, they'll go on and they'll find like, you know, actually, I think I'd rather go back to working in like customer service because it's just less expectation. And that's okay too. If that's the choices that you want to stick with, we're not going to like down you for that. That's a good thing. You found that this doesn't work for you. Or like other folks, they go through the programs and they're like, actually, I want to do more community driven work and I want to work for nonprofits in like program coordination or, you know, organization development or what have you. So yeah, any of those paths I think is a valuable one to learn from. And some of them end up leading to like more opportunities for other students, which is like the best case scenario. So I still hear back from students, still have students that we worked with from cohort one that I'm like, wow. Oh, you're working at a drone company now? What? Like, amazing. I get so excited.
That is exciting. And it speaks of the impact that you're making. So if you could give one short piece of advice to entrepreneurs who are passionate about making an impact in the realms of food access and education, but who are just starting out, what would you say?
I would say start small, think big. It's okay to scale down big idea that you have into like small, achievable, testable models that allow you to really get insight into what the real world is like. Mm-hmm. On paper and with data and with research, things seem like one thing and like numbers can be deceiving, I think, in that way where you're like, oh, all I gotta do is just get this, you know what I mean? Yeah. And then the reality can be vastly, vastly different. And like the lived experience behind it, like the feeling behind it can be really different than what you imagine it might feel like. And so I would say like those small test models can be a really good way to like not just test how effective the solution is, but test how ready you are. And then based on that, start to figure out like, oh, actually, like I'm really not good at not breaking down crying when I thought I got a funding resource and it didn't come through. Like, actually, I need to learn how to meditate. Like I need to learn how to call my friend, go to the gym, work out and cry about it for like 5 minutes and then get back up the next day and not let it knock me down for too long. So start small, but think big and know what your North Star is. Know what the force that's driving you is that keeps you motivated when it gets really, really hard. And ideally that North Star should be something that is beyond just your own fulfillment, should be ideally something that serves other people because sometimes doing it just for ourselves is not enough. We need to do it because we know it'll help other people. So I hope that helps.
It does. That is solid advice. And this whole conversation, Sam, has been like a masterclass conversation. So I've learned so much. I've truly learned so much. So I know the listeners have as well. And they're going to want to know where can they find you, where can they support you, and where can they connect with you. So please do share.
Yes, ma'am. So you can find us on Instagram, on TikTok, on LinkedIn, on Facebook even, at Change Food for Good. That's our handle. If you go to our website, it's www.changefoodforgood.org. You can reach me specifically by emailing me, sam@changefoodforgood.org. Definitely would love to see you guys in our future cohorts. So if you want to sign up for Intro to Ag Tech, hit the register button when you go to our website or refer your friends. And yeah, we'd love to have you in our programs.
Love it. And I can't thank you enough for such a great conversation. And I want to say thank you again for the work that you do and also for being on Communitas of New York.
Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity to share about our work. And Monique, I'm so excited to learn more about your work as well and watch through your podcast. I'm not a big podcast girly, but I'm gonna watch yours. So
I appreciate it. Thank you again, Sam.
Of course.
Since recording this episode, we received an exciting update about Change Food for Good in October 2025. Change Food for Good has launched in the Bronx a cold food storage vending machine that is stocked regularly and can distribute food for free. This is one new facet of their relief model that will allow them to scale up once they have studied the data and requests that come in as a result of community use of this new tool. What a milestone! Congratulations! Visit our website for more information about this and all of our shows. You can find that as well as information about the entrepreneurs and conversation in the show notes. Thank you for listening and see you soon. My name is Monique T. Marshall and this is Communitas of New York. Season 2 is produced by Samoon Jung and David Michael D. Gregoria.